How many of you have a copy of this book? It's my book, Mystery of the Maseron. The reason I mentioned the book is because our next section is going to be about the restoration of creation, and it's going to follow the theme of my book. Now, we're not going to talk so much about the stars and all that kind of stuff, which is the book is about, but the book is divided into 12 chapters, and those 12 chapters tell a story about the redemption of the creation, and we're going to follow the same thing. So what I'm going to do when we get started is I'm going to ask you to read a particular chapter during the week, and then we're going to discuss in the class, we're going to discuss the main theme of that chapter, how it relates to God's redemption of the creation, okay? So keep that book handy. You might want to go ahead and read the introduction again. If you've read it before, read it again. To that, because you get that out of the way, and then when we start, we'll start with the first chapter after that. All right. How many of you were here 2 weeks ago? Okay, we talked about the perspective that the Jews had with regard to time and these terms that are used in the Bible. We have terms like everlasting and forever that we see throughout the Bible. The Jews had a particular perspective on time, which comes really from the creation account, but they considered time from a human perspective that was land-centered, earth-centered. They looked at man as living on the surface of the earth, and he looked up to heaven. He looked down below. He could see a distance in front of him, he could see a distance behind him, and that was pretty much all he could see. And from that perspective, his viewpoint was very limited. And the Jews spoke of time in exactly the same way. Now, I gave you some scriptures last time about how the Bible speaks of our passing life as though we were on a journey. Right, it talks about walking a certain way, things like that. You guys remember that? Yes. All right. So, how would a Jew view passing time? Anybody? Go ahead, Kathy.
Only can see what's right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
You have here, like, only see to the next hill.
Yeah. Okay. So, he views time in the same way that he viewed taking a walk to a destination. All right, walking along a road while, you know, the scenery is passing by you, sort of, from your perspective, the scenery is passing by. That's how he viewed time. And life was a journey to a destination. And every day was another, you know, so far down the road. All right, that's how they view time. And they use this terminology kind of interchangeably. Now, you're limited, when you look at time that way, you're limited by just what is up to the next horizon, right? You can see to the next hill, but you can't see beyond the next horizon. You don't know what's beyond the next horizon. If you're walking along a road, you walk to a certain point, and then you might come up over a horizon, and you can see now, all of a sudden, you can see a good distance ahead of you, right? But only up to the next rise. And then you walk along for a while until you come over to the next rise, and then you can see ahead of you as well. And the Jews had this term called olam. And the term olam meant what was just out of sight. It comes from the verb alam, which means what is concealed or hidden. And this term olam meant that which is just beyond your perception. Okay? Does that make sense? All right. Now, the Greeks, on the other hand, didn't view man from this perspective of being of the ground, of the earth, land-centered. The Greeks believed that man was an eternal being. They believed in immortality of the soul. They believed that souls or ghosts were eternal, that they were in heaven before they became entrapped in human bodies. And therefore, the perspective that they had of both space and time was sort of from up high looking down over everything. And I talked to you a little bit about Google's satellite view and Google, what do they call it?
Street View.
Yeah, if you go on Google Maps, right? You can look at Street View and you can look at satellite view. And if you compare those two things, that's sort of the difference between the Greek way of looking at time and the Hebrew way of looking at time. Hebrew way would be sort of like Street View, where you can hit the little arrow and you can scroll over to the next stop and you can see a little ways, but everything beyond that is sort of out of sight, right? While satellite view, you can look down on everything and you can see everything. You can see the whole world if you just back up a little bit, right? All right, well, that's kind of the difference in those two concepts. This word olam is used over and over and over and over again in the Bible. It's translated in our English Bibles as forever or eternal, but that is not the meaning of the term. In fact, if you go on some websites that talk about ancient Hebrew, I was just on one just a little while ago. It's called ancienthebrew.org. And it talks about this word olam, and using the exact same terminology that I was telling you, that the perspective was of space and time was the same. They use interchangeable words for space and time, and that they viewed this as going on a journey, that it did not mean eternal. It simply meant that which is beyond your field of view, outside of what you can perceive. It's over the horizon. All right, now let's move on to... hold on, I'm trying to catch up on my notes. Let's talk about the superlative form. Week before last, I asked you guys what is a superlative, and I think Chase actually had the answer. Is that right, Chase?
No, it was Caleb.
Caleb. What is a superlative, Caleb? Okay. It's a form of either an adjective or an adverb. Adjectives and adverbs modify either a noun or a verb, right? It's a form of an adjective or an adverb that means the greatest or greater. Now, what it does is it takes the meaning of the adjective or the adverb and it says it is like the most of that. And I gave you an example of fast and faster, right? If you say someone has a fast car, that's an adjective. It's modifying the word car. We know what fast means. But if you say Walter has a fast car or bike in this case, but Isaac has a faster truck, what is faster is a superlative. All right, it's taking the same concept of fast, and it means greater than in comparison to Walter's. All right, or even fastest would be the extreme version of that. All right, now all languages have superlatives, and Hebrew uses superlatives, but in Hebrew, it's done in a couple of different ways. This word olam, which means that which is out of sight, is used as a superlative. There's a couple of ways that it's done in Hebrew. One way is to simply repeat the word, olam, olam. Instead of just saying olam one time, they say olam, olam. All right, now, the meaning of olam, olam is pretty obvious. You know what olam means. You're just emphasizing it, right? It's a superlative. Another way was to make it a plural. In Hebrew, in English, to make a word a plural, we put the letter S on the end usually, right? But in Hebrew, you put the letters, what would approximate our letters, im, at the end of a word, it makes it plural, all right? Just like Eloah is the word God in Hebrew, but Elohim, adding the im ending on it, makes it plural. All right, now, here's the thing that's confusing to people. Plural terms are sometimes used as superlatives in Hebrew. Just like the word God, Elohim, even though it's plural, it's not intended in that case to make God more than one God. All right? The God, for example, in Genesis 1, it says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. It uses the word Elohim, which is plural there. Now, does that mean God's plural created the heaven and the earth? No, that's not the point. What Hebrew does, it has what is called the majestic plural. The majestic plural is simply making a term plural in order to make it a superlative. That is to make it greater. Same meaning, but it's greater. It's not that it's more than one, it's that it's greater or greatest of whatever it is that word is being used for. All right? Can you guys comprehend that? Does that make sense? All right. So what Hebrew does is it takes this word olam, which means time that's just out of sight, it's just over the horizon, and it will either repeat it, olam, olam, or sometimes it will repeat it and use the plural, and it'll say olam, olamim. All right? Now, what is that saying? Excuse me?
Larger.
It's greater. Its meaning is even greater than its basic meaning. All right? It always strengthens the meaning of the word to a greater degree. It doesn't give it a different meaning. This is something that you have to understand. It doesn't give it a different meaning. So if I say a car is fast and another car is faster, fast and faster have the same meaning. It's just that one is greater in its meaning than the other. Right? It's exactly the same with olam. Olam means what is concealed or hidden from sight. It's out of view. It's over the horizon, so you can't see it. So if you say olam olam, using a superlative form, or olam olamim, what are you doing? You're saying it's even more concealed. You're not saying it's forever and ever. You're saying it is time that is concealed from sight. It's over the horizon. It might be over two horizons. In other words, it might be that if you get to the next horizon and you see the next horizon, it still will be out of sight. All right, it's simply making it greater in its basic meaning. Now, the problem is, when the Bible was translated into Greek from Hebrew, whenever you translate from one language to another, there's always problems. The reason there are always problems is because every language is different. The rules of grammar in every language are different. There are not always exact equivalent words in different languages. So when you come to the word olam and its use as a superlative, olam olam, or olam olamim, when you come to that word and you're trying to translate that into another language, if the other language doesn't do that is, it doesn't use a plural as a superlative. As far as I know, Hebrew is the only language that actually does that, uses it in the plural, all right, to make a superlative. Other languages have other ways of doing that. All right. But when you translate into another language, you have to find a way to try to convey the meaning the best you can into the other language. Now, most of you know what the Septuagint is. If you know what the Septuagint is, let me see your hand. All right, just about everybody. The Septuagint, abbreviated by the Roman numerals LXX, which is 70, is a translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek that was made about 300 years before Christ was born. And it was made by Jewish scholars who knew very well, they understood and knew Hebrew and they knew Greek. And so they translated the Bible from Hebrew into Greek. Now, when they got to this word olam, they had to convey this concept in Hebrew of time that is over the horizon, that is out of sight, that is, it's not revealed, it's not seen. They had to convey this idea using Greek words. But Greek doesn't have a word that means what olam means. It doesn't have a word that means time over the horizon or time that's out of sight, right? Out of your immediate field of view. And so they used a phrase to translate the word olam in Hebrew. Let me get to this now, the Greek Old Testament. Again, there is no Greek word that means exactly what olam means. There's also no Greek word that means forever, that is, without end. Just like in Hebrew, let me ask you this. How do you express the concept of forever in Hebrew? There's a way to express it. Does anybody know? I told you this last time. No. That doesn't mean forever.
In
Hebrew, well, actually, it's in Hebrew or Greek. There's a way. There's if you wanted to say something is going to last forever.
Without end.
You simply take the word end, and you negate it, right? No end. It has no end. And I gave you examples of that in the scripture. There's a passage in Isaiah which talks about Christ's kingdom. Will have no end. Now, there's no, it's not, that's not one word. You have to make a phrase in order to convey that concept in Hebrew, but it's also the same in Greek. There is no single word in Hebrew or Greek that means forever. But you can express the idea by saying something has no end. All right? That's basically forever. Now, the question now becomes, how did these scholars who translated the Old Testament into Greek, how did they translate this word olam in the Hebrew, or sorry, in the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint? They used a phrase. And the phrase literally says, unto the age. Unto the age. Okay? Now, if we're going to understand that phrase in Greek, it's eiston, ion, ion, excuse me, eiston, ion, in Greek. Three words. Eis is a preposition which means unto, ton is the definite article, the, and ion is the word age. Now, what does the word age mean in Greek? Ion. Does anybody know? It can be indefinite, but it's used in a lot of ways. But basically what it simply means is the allotted time for something. Let me ask you this. What is your age? And I'm going to use the English word because actually we use the English word the same way. Stephen, what is your age?
49.
49 years. That is Stephen's age. That's Stephen's ion. If you were speaking Greek. In this case, this particular ion is 49 years long. Now, is that forever? No. No. An age is never infinite in the Greek language. Ion is not infinite. It is not forever. It's, in fact, Aristotle used, who was one of the Greek philosophers, probably one of the very first what we would call scientists. Aristotle used the word ion for very short periods of time, but in his writings, it simply meant the time that was allotted for any particular thing. All right? That's what the word means. Now, you can see now, if you understand what the Hebrew word olam means, and what does it mean again? Till time concealed. That is, the ending of it is out of your sight. It's out of your perception. Okay? It's fuzzy. It's over the horizon. All right. Now, in Greek, if they say unto the ion, eis ton ion, unto the age. And what is an age again? It's a limited period of time, the time allotted to any particular thing. Okay? Whatever that time happens to be. It could be the hour of this service could be called an ion in Greek. All right? It's the time that's allotted for this particular class. So if you say unto the ion, eiston ion in Greek, what is it saying? It's saying until the end of this allotted time. That's all it's saying. Until the next allotted time that follows after this allotted time. Now, you can understand how these translators of the Septuagint, why they use that phrase that way to translate olam. Because olam meant what is in our view until what is out of our view. Okay? Like from here until over the next horizon. All right, that makes sense. Now, if you're a Greek person and you translate it until the age, or unto the age, an age in Greek thinking was this particular situation that we're in now, okay, that's allotted to this time, so until the next situation. All right, you can see that there's a it's not an exact equivalent to the Hebrew olam, but you can see the similarity. Can you guys see that and why they would translate it that way? All right. Now, one of the things I pointed out to you was there are a great many statements in the Bible that use the Hebrew word olam or the superlative forms of it, olam olam or olam olamim. They use these forms for periods of time that clearly were finite periods of time. And I gave you some examples of that. One of them was the the case where a slave, if at the end of 6 years, with the law required that all slaves be freed on the sabbatical year, that a particular slave could say, well, I like my master and I have a good situation here and I want to be permanent, the permanent slave of this master where he doesn't have to release me because I have security here, right? He could then have his ear bored through with an awl, and then he became the slave of that master, and the text literally says, olam. All right? Now, is he his slave forever into eternity? No. He was his slave for the rest of his life. So in that case, olam meant until he died. That's all. Just meant until he died. His death was not known exactly when that would be. It's over the horizon, so that's how it was expressed in Hebrew. In the Greek Old Testament, it says he would be his slave, eis ton aeon, unto the age. That is, for the remainder of the age until the next age. And the age here is his lifespan again. All right? You see, it makes perfect sense. There are plenty of examples where this was a very short period of time. Another one, I'll give you another one off the top of my head. In Samuel, you remember when Hannah dedicated Samuel to live at the temple, right? When he was a little boy, after he was weaned, she turned him over to the priests at the temple, and he was going to live at the temple, olam. That's what it says. Or in the Greek version, unto the age, eis ton aion. That's what it says. Now, does that mean Samuel is going to live in the temple into eternity, forever and forever and forever? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It simply means for the foreseeable future. That's all it meant. It was for the rest of his life in this particular case. The context kind of helps to determine the length of it. But it does not mean forever and ever. And we have lots and lots of examples where God gave certain commandments, and he said that this is an olam commandment. But yet the New Testament says that this has all come to an end. You know, creates many contradictions in the Bible. If you take that word to mean forever and ever, as it does in English, if you take it that way in the Bible, it creates all kinds of contradictions. And I want to just show you one of the major problems with understanding olam or eis ton aion to mean forever. One of the major contradictions that this creates, and it's a very serious contradiction, all right? So take your Bibles and go to Exodus chapter 40. Verse 13. This is when Moses was establishing the Levitical priesthood. Aaron, who was a son of Levi, became the high priest. And it says, verse 13, you shall put the holy garments on Aaron and anoint him and consecrate him that he may minister to me as a priest. Then you shall bring his sons and clothe them with tunics. You shall anoint them as you anointed their father, that they may minister to me as priests, for their anointing shall surely be, now notice this, an everlasting priesthood throughout their generations. Note the word everlasting, that's the word olam in Hebrew. All right? Olam. In Greek, it's eis ton aeon, unto the age. All right? Now, look at Leviticus. Flip over to Leviticus chapter 7. Verse 34. For the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of the heave offering, I have taken from the children of Israel, from the sacrifice of their peace offerings, and I have given them to Aaron the priest and to his sons from the children of Israel by a statute forever. And this is olam, all right, or in Greek, eis ton aeon. This is the consecrated portion for Aaron and his sons from the offerings made by fire to the Lord on the day when Moses presented them to minister to the Lord as priests. The Lord commanded this to be given to them by the children of Israel on the day that he anointed them by a statute forever. Again, olam in the Hebrew or eis ton aeon in the Greek. Throughout their generations. Now, what we have, there are literally scores and scores of examples of olam commandments given with regard to the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood. In fact, most of the commandments that God gave specifically for the priesthood are said to be olam commandments. That is, they're translated eternal or forever in your English Bible. All right, but they're olam in the Hebrew, or they are eis ton aeon in the Greek version. Now, I want you to go over to Numbers chapter 25. Verse 10. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be on him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel. Again, olam is the word there, or eis ton aeon in Greek, in the Greek version. All right, now, is this priesthood, this covenant of the Levitical priesthood, really an everlasting priesthood? Was it an everlasting priesthood? No.
It didn't exist after 70 AD.
That's exactly right. I want you to go here. I want to show you what the New Testament says about this. Okay? Go to Hebrews chapter 7. Verse 11, it's talking about Christ coming as, according to the order of Melchizedek, as a priest of a different kind. Hebrews 7, verse 11. Therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should arise according to the order of Melchizedek, and not called according to the order of Aaron? Now remember, all those passages we just read were about the priesthood that was given to Aaron, who was a Levite. For the priesthood being changed, of necessity there is also a change of the law. All right? For he of whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, from which no man has officiated at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord arose from Judah, of which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning priesthood. And it is yet far more evident if in the likeness of Melchizedek there arises another priest who has come, not according to the law of a fleshly commandment, but according to the power of an endless life. For he testifies, you are a priest forever. And again, this is olam in Hebrew, or it is unto the age, or eis ton aeon in Greek, according to the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, there is an annulling. Now notice this word. There is an annulling of the former commandment because of its weakness and unprofitableness. For the law made nothing perfect, On the other hand, there is the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. Now, what is Paul saying? He's saying that God took away the old priesthood and the old covenant that went with it to establish a new priesthood. So then, again, the question is, was the old priesthood an everlasting priesthood? No, it was not. Because the word olam doesn't mean everlasting. It simply means until time out of sight. And it was, from that particular perspective. Now, let me ask you this. If the Jews of Jesus' day, or if the Jews of the apostles' day, understood olam as forever, instead of, like it's translated in our English Bibles, instead of the way I've described it to you, what would their very first reaction be? They did not believe Jesus was the Christ. When you have the Apostle Paul writing stuff like this, that the old priesthood has been abolished and taken away to establish the new priesthood of Christ according to the order of Melchizedek, what would be their very first argument? Jesus cannot be a new priest according to the order of Melchizedek because the order of Aaron was forever. That would be their very first argument. They never brought up that argument. They didn't bring up that argument. They didn't use that. That would be the best argument to overturn the message that the apostles were preaching. They didn't use that argument. Why didn't they use that argument? Because they knew that that word didn't mean that. That's why. It was perfectly well understood what that terminology meant. And it's not what our modern English Bibles have, unfortunately. That is forever. In English, forever means without end. It's not what it means. All right? Okay. So, what happens when in the New Testament, the apostles come along and they are writing the books of the New Testament. What Old Testament did they normally use for their quotations? The Greek Old Testament, right? The Greek Old Testament. So how would they, what kind of terminology would they use in the New Testament then to convey these ideas? Where would they get that terminology, that phraseology from? The Greek Old Testament. They're writing in Greek in the New Testament, right? They use the Greek Old Testament as their source for terminology. I mean, this can be proven over and over again in the Bible, but if you read the book of Hebrews, if you do even a little bit of research into the quotations in the book of Hebrews from the Old Testament, and there are tons and tons and tons of quotations from the Old Testament in the book of Hebrews, every single quote comes from the Greek version of the Old Testament, not the Hebrew version. How do I know that? Because there are several places where the point that the Apostle Paul makes cannot be made from the Hebrew text, because it doesn't say exactly the same thing as the Greek text does. But Paul uses the Greek text to make his points, all right? Because there were some changes in the Hebrew text over time, all right? But the Greek text he uses to make his points. So we would expect that the New Testament writers would simply borrow the same terminology from the Old Testament. Now, we talked a little while ago about the superlative forms of the Hebrew. What were the superlative forms of olam? Olam, olam, that is just doubling the word. Or olam, olamim, that is olam singular and then olam plural. All right? Now, when we look at those terms in the Hebrew Bible and we compare them to the Greek version of the Bible, we see how the translators handled that. Now, Hebrew has that what's called the majestic plural. That is, you can use a plural term to simply make the concept greater as opposed to making it plural. The Hebrew language does that. Greek language doesn't do that. So what did the Greek translators do when they were faced with olam olam or olam olamim? How did they handle it? Well, we know that just olam was translated eis tan ion, right? Unto the age. So how did they translate olam olam? Well, because the word olam is used twice as a superlative, they said unto the ages. They made ages plural. And then they were faced with other places where the Hebrew says olam, olamim. Now they have another problem because they have, how do you express that in Greek? Because you could say unto the age, all right, singular, and then if you have olam, olam, you could say, okay, unto the ages, plural. But now if you have unto the age, ages, what did they do? They said unto the age, ages of ages. They simply pluralized it again, and they added ages again. All right? Now you can see when they're faced with these kinds of differences in language why they would do it that way, but that's how they did it. All right, unto the ages of ages, or unto the age of ages sometimes. All right, there are plenty of examples of this. Well, I won't say plenty. There are a few examples of this in the Old Testament. Unto the, in the Septuagint, unto the ages of ages is a fairly rare term, but it does appear in the Greek Old Testament. All right, now, that term is used of limited periods of time. Even the expression unto the ages of ages is used in the Psalms of limited periods of time. Let me see if I can find it here. Psalm 119:44. David says, so shall I keep thy law continually. And it says in the King James Version, forever and ever. In the Greek version, it says, unto the ages of the ages. All right. Literally, it says, I will keep your law unto the age, unto the ages of ages. And he's talking about the law of Moses. David's talking about the law of Moses. He also, there's another psalm, and I don't have it right in front of me. There's another psalm where he talks about singing praises to God in his temple. And he said, I'm going to keep doing this unto the ages of the ages. Again, using that same terminology. What does he mean by it? All he's doing... Did David mean he's going to sing these psalms in God's temple into all eternity? No, that's not the point. He's saying, I'm going to keep doing this until time out of sight. And then he makes it a superlative, until time really out of sight. In other words, I'm really, really going to keep doing this, God. That's all he's saying. See? And when we get to the New Testament and we see these terms like unto the age, or unto the ages of the ages, which is how the Greek would actually reads. Again, it's simply making the basic concept into a superlative. All right? To stress it even greater. It's not forever and ever. Yeah, Walter, is that your hand going up?
Yeah. Could it mean in that situation there when David's saying he's going to praise the Lord in his temple?
No. No, actually he uses, I skipped over one one thing because I didn't think I had time for it. There's also another expression in Hebrew called ad olam. It adds the word ad in front of olam. Now, ad is a preposition. And it's simply, in English, it would be until. And it expresses the idea of continuous, unbroken action. Okay, so if you said olam, in Hebrew, you're saying until, or you're saying time out of sight. But if you say ad olam, you're saying continuously until time out of sight. That is unbroken, action unbroken until time out of sight. This is the phrase that God used when he made the promise to Abraham that he'd give him the land. Ad olam. Okay? And continuously. So when David uses that, he says ad olam, olamim, I believe, is what David said there. It's continuously, I'm going to praise you continuously. If he was talking about in the kingdom or something like that, he wouldn't be accounting for his death. Understand? All right. So anyway. All right. Any questions about that? Here's the problem that the implications. If we take this word olam, the way it's translated in our English Bibles as forever, that's how it's translated. Most of the time, not always, but most of the time, it's translated as forever. If we take it that way, And that is the meaning of the word. It creates all kinds of paradoxes in the Bible where God says certain things are forever that are not forever. And they're clearly not forever. And the New Testament says they're not forever. All right? But here's the biggest problem. If olam means forever, then Jesus' priesthood is illegitimate. You get that? You see why? Over and over again, I could literally give you scores and scores of examples where the Levitical priesthood is said to be olam, forever, if you translate it that way. But yet the New Testament clearly says it was not, and that Christ's priesthood supersedes it, and it's done away with in order to establish Christ's priesthood. I didn't make this stuff up. Okay, you can actually go online. If you look up ancient Hebrew, different websites that talk about ancient Hebrew, they'll tell you the same things that I'm telling you here. That was the concept of the word olam. What has happened in the meantime? What's happened is the ideas of some of the Greek philosophers like Plato and so forth, that man is not made from dust. You know, God made man out of the dust of the ground for a reason. You know what that was? Why did he make us out of dust? Why did he make us out of stardust? Instead, yeah, exactly right. Instead of dust of this ground. To keep us humble and to keep our feet firmly centered on the ground. We are part of this earth. We are part of this ground. We are made from the chemicals and elements of this ground. He wants us to view ourselves as dust. Why did he call Adam Adam? What, God named him. Why did he call Adam Adam? That's what it means. Dirt. Adam is dirt. And why does God call the whole human race Adam? You know that the word Adam in Hebrew is used of both the first man and all of his descendants. We are the race of Adam, the race of dirt. Why does God call us that? Why does he remind us that all through the Torah? Because he wants us to keep the proper focus of what we are, of who we are, of how we came here, how we got here, right? The Jews had the proper understanding of what a man is based on the creation account. The Greeks, on the other hand, had high philosophical ideas about what a man was, that he was some kind of a spirit being who descended from the heavens and was imprisoned in a physical body, and he is intended to escape it at some point and ascend back into the heavens, that he's an eternal being. And so the Greek perspective, as opposed to the Hebrew perspective, are like day and night apart from each other. All right? But when the Bible ends up in the Greek world and in the Greek culture and in the Greek language, then this kind of terminology starts getting understood based on Greek ideas and Greek worldviews and things like that. And this happened long before Christ even came. We have the Bible already being interpreted in ways like that. We see Jewish mysticism starting to creep in shortly after the Babylonian exile. There were Jews who began to accept a lot of the doctrines of Plato. And you had the Essenes and other mystical Jews, and today there's a whole branch of Judaism, Jewish mystics, that teach the very same things that Plato taught, that, you know, we are eternal beings that have always existed, that have now descended into a body. You've heard of Kabbalah, the whole tree of life thing, which that's their view of tree of life, has nothing to do with ours, but theirs is a mystical thing, but but anyway. This is what has happened. And because our Western civilization is based very much on the writings of the Greek philosophers, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but Aristotle and Plato and others, their influence on Western society is enormous. And, you know, the Romans and the West was settled by people who were influenced by this Western way of thinking, as opposed to the Eastern way of thinking of the Semites, the Jews and Arabs and so forth, which have a totally different perspective on things as well. All right, but Now, the last problem is if Olam or Eistan Ion means infinity, not only is Jesus' priesthood illegitimate, but there's a logical contradiction. Because you cannot have a superlative of forever. You cannot have a superlative of infinity. Is that right? If forever is infinity, then how do you make forever a superlative that is greater than infinity? Because infinity means there's nothing greater. It's forever. It goes on forever and ever, right? You cannot have an infinite. And how do you even express it?
An infinite.
You cannot have a superlative. If forever is forever, then you cannot have a forever and ever. It doesn't make any sense. All right? The only way to have logical harmony in the scripture and to have the Old and the New Testaments harmonized together perfectly is to understand this term the way it was originally intended to be understood, and that is simply means time concealed, time out of sight, time over the horizon. That's all it means. And if you take that meaning and you understand the basic meaning and you understand that there are superlative forms of it, and you use that meaning every time this appears in the Bible, there are no contradictions. It makes perfectly good sense. But if you make it forever, then over here it can mean forever, but over here it can't mean forever, and you have all and if you do make it mean forever, you have all these contradictions all over the place. Where God becomes a liar. He says something is going to be forever and it's not. That's the problem. All right? The correct way to handle it is to find harmony. Whenever you're defining terms, you don't make a term, you don't say a term, well, the term is broad enough to include a limited time, and infinity. Well, then how do you determine which it is in any particular context? It's not that way. That's not how the terminology works. What you do is you find a definition of the term that will fit and agree every place that is found in the scriptures without forcing it. And that's what we have here. If you understand this term as meaning, simply meaning that the end of this thing is out of sight, it's something that has not been revealed, then all the passages make perfectly good sense. All right, yeah, Jordan?
Is there a Greek phrase or term for endless time?
There's a phrase, yes, but not a single word.
What's the phrase that's used for that?
I don't know the Greek version. I mean, I can't say it in Greek without looking it up. But, yes, I can too. Euktelos, without end. Or a telos, you could put the negative article a in front of telos. Telos means end.
Do you know which verses use that term?
There's a lot of verses that actually have that. Well, I won't say a lot. There are several verses that have that. But I gave one example a couple of weeks ago where Isaiah chapter 9 verses 6 and 7 talk about his kingdom. Of his kingdom there will be no end. All right, that's how it would be translated in English, no end, okay, or have no end. That would mean it goes on into infinity. But that's the only way of expressing that, either in Hebrew or in Greek, is to say it has no end. There's not a single word that means infinite like there is in English, or forever as there is in English. There is no word like that in Hebrew or in Greek. All right? All right, everybody get that? Well, it's because Greek philosophical thought has put a lot of pressure on theology over the years. You know, it's not the fault of any one person. It's that language evolves over time because of ideas that become prominent in a culture, and unfortunately, because largely of the Roman Catholic Church, which has so much of this Greek philosophical concepts embedded into its theology, that then the use of the language by Catholics has evolved even on its own. And so when we get to English, you've got people who already have these preconceived, translators who have these preconceived ideas from Catholic theology. A lot of Protestantism is really has a lot of Catholicism still tangled up with it, you know? And so when you've got Bible translators that come out of these backgrounds, they're gonna, you know, translate it the way that agrees with their theology. But if you try to take terms like this and find harmony in the scriptures, you'll see that there are a lot of mistakes being made, and they're serious mistakes.